Automated Podcast.
Welcome to Automated. I'm your host, Mark Verbenkov, and in this weekly podcast, we will be exploring the impact of emerging technology on jobs, society, as well as us, with business and technology leaders, researchers, and independent professionals across the world. So overall, this podcast has largely focused on a 10-year time horizon when exploring the emerging technologies that the many guests have brought up. And the main reason for this is that it's actually quite a challenge to predict what changes will come after this point due to the accelerating nature of technological development and the convergences between these technologies. But in today's episode, we look beyond the 10-year time horizon for the future of work with the help of futurist Matthew Griffin. So if you've ever wondered what jobs or skills will be relevant in the coming decades, this conversation should give you a really great place to start. And as we touched on many different topics, the conversation will be broken down into two different episodes, with this first part looking at the megatrends and technologies that are impacting the future of work, which industries will be disrupted, and what soft and hard skills will be needed for individuals for the coming decades. So Matthew Griffin has been recognized for the past 6 years as one of the world's foremost futurists, innovation and strategy experts. He is an international speaker who helps governments, investors, multinationals, and regulators around the world envision, build, and lead an inclusive, sustainable future. He's been described the advisor behind the advisors and a young Kurzweil. He is the founder and CEO of the 311 Institute, a global futures and deep futures consultancy working across the next 50 years, and the World Futures Forum and Exponential University, two philanthropic organizations whose mission is to reduce global inequality in all its forms and ensure the benefits of the future are accessible to everyone, irrespective of their abilities or background. He's the author of the futuristic Codex of the Future series and the book How to Build Exponential Enterprises. Matthew's clients include world leaders, royalty, G7 and G20 governments, and well-known multinationals including Accenture, Aon, BCG, Centrica, Deloitte, LinkedIn, Microsoft, Qualcomm, and many, many others. Great. Matt, thank you very much for coming on to the Automated Podcast. It's great to have you here today. I've looked at your website. I've looked at some of the keynotes that you gave. I'm very happy to have you on and to explain some of the things that you do. I think it's really interesting.
No, thank you, Mark.
So one of the things that I like to start off with all of my guests is to also give maybe a little bit more of a personal touch to the ideas that you give out. Where did your initial interest come with foresight, with futurism, with technology? These are kind of some of the main topics that we'll be touching on, as well as the future of work. So just kind of like getting your own personal interest. Where did that initially come from?
So thank you for the question. So I've always been interested in technology and science. So actually, not a lot of people know this, but my background is I'm a marine biologist and oceanographer. I used to be a park ranger and everything else. I work with the UNHCR basically on the coral reefs of Belize and the Caribbean and all the way around the world. Mm-hmm. So Arctic environmental ecosystems, coral reef ecosystems, that kind of stuff. Fell into technology early on, so a little bit by accident. Ended up working sort of for companies like, you know, EMC, IBM, Atos, those kinds of organizations. And then, frankly, that's where I've always had an interest in the future. Mm-hmm. But it was really within those organizations that my interest in the future basically went from, should we say, middle gear basically to high gear. And there were a couple of reasons for that. You know, so firstly, you know, when you have a look at the vast majority of organizations on the planet, you know, they care about three things, really. Reduce cost, reduce risk, and grow revenues. Yeah. The vast majority of technology organizations are great at talking to companies about the first two, but they aren't really that good about talking about the third. The third one, growing revenues. Mm-hmm. But what really sort of got me engaged basically with the future was the fact that so many of the organizations that I worked for, along with as well as the organizations that I worked with, really had difficulty seeing the future. And the main impact that that caused on the ground was redundancies. Mm. So, you know, if you have a look at IBM, for example, you know, I was there during the times where, you know, they laid off 50,000 people because at that stage, AWS, you know, the cloud company basically was starting to come up. IBM had seen cloud, but they'd not really sort of got their head around it. They'd not really figured out what strategy they were going to use to try to sort of, you know, tackle Amazon head on or even tackle the industry head on. Basically, so they kind of had a really slow burn, slow start basically in there. And, you know, when you have a look at all of the different organizations' responses to the future, generally the future is something that they often feel is done to them. And because it's done to them, when their businesses are disrupted, the first thing that they do is they make loads of people redundant in order to improve their operating costs and get cost off the balance sheet. But those people are just generally kicked to the curb. You know, they're given a severance package of, you know, anywhere between 1 to 6 months worth of pay, depending on sort of, you know, how long they've been in the companies. And you know, they're given some mediocre training. They are given a tentative introduction to a CV writing company. And, you know, all these companies that make them redundant say, you know, thanks for working with us. You know, we wish you all the best in the future. P.S., you know, we suggest that you change the font on your CV and good luck with all of that. Bye. You're not our problem any longer. And I just personally felt that on the one hand, basically, that was just a huge waste of human potential and capital, you know, especially when you consider that you could, if you could see the future far enough ahead, you could just retrain those people. You know, Accenture is a great example of a company that's seen the future. They have put a variety of different plans in place to try to capitalize on it and prosper from it. And a little while ago, you know, they made 17,000 positions redundant without making anyone redundant, you know, so we can do it. And, you know, as I was sort of developing different future strategies basically within these different sort of organizations, I kind of got to the point where I thought, well, why can't I just do this for myself? You know, why am I actually stuck in the political and bureaucratic machinery of some of these large Fortune 100 organizations when actually I think I can be more effective outside of them? You know, like most entrepreneurs, you know, entrepreneurs basically are generally people who won't work for you because, you know, it's just not how they operate. And they don't like sort of being trodden on, you know, or blocked or, you know, filtered or bottlenecked or all these sort of other things. And that was it. And then I came out of these companies and here we are.
And so maybe that's the perfect segue into the 311 Institute, right? So this is the institute, the think tank that you founded. So I haven't had a futurist on the podcast before. What I typically do is I talk to the businesses that are creating the future. Yeah. Can you touch a little bit on the institute itself, if it's anything different from what you were speaking just a moment ago?
It's not. Well, so it's a little bit different, not too different. But 311 Institute, I see, is a global futures think tank and advisory organization. So we look 50 years out. And the reason why we look 50 years out, and you can look 50 years out, albeit things get fuzzier the further out you get and the broader your scope. So I'll throw that in there before everyone says you can't see the future. You know, you can, and I'll prove the point in a minute. So the reason why we look sort of 50 years out is because if you're a multinational organization, typically you care about the next 5, 10, maybe 20 years. But if you're a sovereign government, you typically care about the next 50 years, anywhere from the modern day basically to the next 50 years, because you care about the future of jobs, skills and labor, you know, the future of energy and infrastructure, transportation, you know, education, you know, all these kinds of different sort of areas of society, healthcare, the welfare state, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, with the 311 Institute, we sort of cross pretty much every technology. So there are over 450 exponential technologies, everything from molecular assemblers, which are here, all the way through to things like molecular robots, DNA robots, all the way through to AI and the usual AR, VR, blockchains and all these kinds of other bits and bobs. But it's, you know, when it comes to kind of seeing the future, people who say that you can't see the future, I think, are a little bit narrow in their thinking. Because if you go to the average person on the street and you ask them, you know, what do you think the future of transportation looks like? You know, what do you think the future of the car looks like? You know, they will inevitably kind of say, well, electric. They might say autonomous. And then you say to them, well, you must be a futurist then, you know, if you can predict the future of, you know, mobility and transport. And actually, it's not. It's data points. You know, they can see electric cars on the roads. They can see them on the websites. They can see them in the marketing. They can see them in the press. They can see them they can see regulators are starting to approve them. You know, they can go and touch and buy one. They can see people talking about them. So when it comes to trying to predict the future, it's data points. But the further out that you get, the broader your field of view, the fuzzier everything gets, because there are so many variables that can kind of kick that future in a different direction. And then from a futurist perspective, you know, it's not just what does the future look like, it's when is that thing going to emerge, and what is the impact of that thing on me, my business, my country, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, which I think would be so highly relevant for these governments and for the businesses that you're consulting with, to make their workforce not redundant at a specific point in time.
Well, I mean, absolutely. You know, I mean, if you have a look at the, you know, certainly post-COVID, the future of work and the workforce basically is coming into more focus than it's ever been before. You know, if we just have a kind of look at this, just one stat. So I've sort of been writing a new codex. One stat that really stands out for me, just to kind of put the economic impact basically of COVID into perspective at an individual level, is the world's billionaires within 1 year. So that's kind of March 2020 to March 2021, have increased their overall net worth by $3.9 trillion. So it's now standing at about $11.2 trillion. When you have a look at the world's sort of, you know, general working population, the estimate is that they have lost $3.7 trillion, almost the equivalent in earnings. Hence, we see this kind of this increasing, you know, wealth inequality and sort of, you know, these wealth gaps basically coming through. And yeah, from a government perspective, governments are in the hole for tens of trillions of dollars now. They've got to find ways basically to kind of get that money back onto the books so they can balance their economies. The only real way that they can do that is via taxation. Governments basically sort of see that global economic power is shifting, the workforce and how people work and where people work basically, and all these sorts of things basically are shifting as well. And yeah, they are increasingly worried basically about, you know, how do we actually get, you know, if you look at the UK, you know, how do we get the $2.1 trillion worth of debt that the UK owes various, you know, global asset managers and everything else back? So that we can prosper as a nation. It's the same with Europe, you know, with the, what, $1.85 trillion stimulus, you know, the European recovery plan, US, you know, $2 trillion basically over there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and I think, as you rightly pointed out, COVID is kind of the event that pushed all of these things really into the forefront of everybody's minds. Whereas before, you know, maybe you would go about your day, go about your year, not really thinking about these things. But right now, it's in everybody's faces kind of all the time.
And I mean, even when you have a look at, you know, when you have a look at COVID, ironically, you know, if you have a look at trends, you know, some of the mega trends that sort of been going on, you can categorize most trends according to a methodology that's called STEEP, you know, which stands for, you know, society, technology, economics or economy, environment and politics. And COVID has had a major detrimental impact on all of them, except for technology and the environment. So the environment's obviously improved. Technology has come to the forefront as a tool that we can use to try to get back to the new normal, the great reset, you know, to build back better, the recovery plan. And you can kind of guess which particular continent has come up with the name of the recovery plan, as opposed to, you know, all these other sort of fancy, you know, these fancy marketing taglines, basically, that some of these people have come up with. It's taken a swathe right out of all of these different mega trends and left very little untouched.
Well, maybe let's dive into that a little bit more, but focus more on kind of the future of work, right? So the podcast itself really looks at the future of work, how automation, and I guess we'll get into it a little bit later, the kind of autonomous nature of a lot of these future businesses and technologies that are coming out. You know, we've been talking about COVID. Obviously, digitalization and remote work are two of the main trends within COVID as it relates to the future of work that is in everybody's faces. This is blatant. I mean, this is how we're communicating now. What are some of the other mega trends as it relates to the future of work that you've seen, apart from the kind of COVID wave that we've been all smacked in the face by?
So you've got a few. So, you know, firstly, when we have a look at work from home, it's not work from home, it's work from anywhere. Additionally, you can actually apply work from anywhere to an increasing number of non-traditional job types. So very fast examples, you know, we've got construction workers in Germany who are based in Germany who are using 5G and teleoperations technologies to build buildings in South Korea. You know, that's, you know, working from home as a construction worker has never traditionally been a thing. You know, when we have a look at surgeons, for example, we've got the University College of London and we've got Barts, as well as a couple of other hospitals around the world where during COVID, their surgeons basically were in lockdown. You know, they were, you know, they weren't able to actually leave their houses because they were either ill, suffering, or just because of the sort of the general environments they were in. Using sort of mixed reality technology. So this is things like, you know, Microsoft HoloLens, basically, as well as, again, you know, teleoperations, telepresence, you know, different robotic systems, 5G, again, was sort of where it's available. An increasing number of those surgeons were not only able to direct surgeries from home, they were also able to conduct surgeries from home. So, you know, this is where we bring in things like haptics technologies, basically, you know, ultra-fast network connections, all that sort of stuff. So, as I say, you know, work, it's not work from home, it's work from anywhere. But increasingly, there are more and more jobs that traditionally people have never really thought of as being able to work from home or from outside of a centralized location that we can now perform. There's also then the sort of the concept of hybrid work. Now, when, you know, when we have a look at hybrid work, this is where we are almost on the verge of seeing conversational artificial intelligence coming through. So that's AIs that you can actually have a conversation with. You know, if you have a look at, say, Siri or Alexa at the moment, if you try and have a natural conversation with them, after kind of one or two, after sort of what saying one or two things, they have no idea what you're talking about and they just revert to type. But, you know, we've got some quite spectacular developments over the past year in conversational artificial intelligence. And in the sort of next 12 months, you'll start seeing, you know, companies like Amazon starting to roll out AIs that you can have conversations with. Now, the reason sort of why I'm saying this is this applies basically to what I call under the concept of hybrid work. So as a human worker, typically you'll go into whatever office you can go into and you'll do your work in a traditional way. You know, you'll do your own admin, you know, you'll do your own cold calling, you'll do your own spreadsheets, whatever it happens to be. Increasingly, we've got automation that will take care of a lot of those lower, what we call lower cognitive tasks. But increasingly, as conversational artificial intelligence and digital humans become the new computer interface, as a human worker, you can now start augmenting your own work with them. And a simple example of that would be you can sit down, say, in front of your Salesforce system and say to your Salesforce system, you know, I've got a target of $1 million this month as a sales guy. You know, which customers do you think I should phone? And yeah, platforms like Einstein will come back and say, well, you know, I've had a look at, I know the products that your company sells. I know your account set. Because that's in the CRM system. I've been using big data to trawl basically all of the information that I could find about all of your prospects. And I found this CIO of Walmart tweeting about how great, you know, public cloud is. And bearing in mind, I know that you sell public cloud. I think that you should probably go and have a conversation with him about that. You know, here's a whole bunch of different sets of data about him. Yeah, this is the best way to get hold of him. And once you get hold of him, this is kind of the conversation you should actually have. So with hybrid work, we've got artificial intelligence kind of acting as a as an augmentation tool. So hence AI, you know, augmented intelligence as well as AI. But what humans are really good at, humans are good at sort of, you know, lateral creative thinking. And that's fine in some scenarios. Artificial intelligence is fantastic, increasingly fantastic, at sifting through huge volumes of data in real time to extract meaning, content, context, and purpose. And when you start combining those together, all of a sudden, it does mean that you can work in more productive ways. You know, say, for example, you've got a global asset manager and he wants to go through shares. It's kind of like that Star Trek computer. Rather than, you know, if you look at Bloomberg, rather than having to go through all these different data sets and tables to figure out which stock to buy, you just ask the computer, what stock do I buy? And it says Apple. And then using explainable artificial intelligence, you dive into it and say, well, why Apple? You know, why not Amazon? And it will say, well, based on your criteria on exits and investment strategy and your appetite for risk and stuff, I said Apple because, you know, it meets these particular criteria. So we've got hybrid work and we've got AI starting to come into the workplace. And then, you know, when we have a look at some of the other trends, teleoperations, telepresence. Yeah, if you have a look at, for example, Microsoft HoloLens, you know, they will kind of market that as a technology that they would market it as a mixed reality technology for work. I think on the one hand, they kind of miss the point and they don't like they won't like me saying that. But realistically, what Microsoft HoloLens does is it gives people a way to digitize someone's physical presence. And that's interesting because, you know, while you and I are sort of having this conversation basically over the kind of the traditional wires, when we look at hiring strategies, a lot of companies will say, what we want to do is we want to hire people, particular people that look like this, you know, with these skills, but we would like them to be able to sit down with our teams in Madrid or London because we want to be able to encourage that one-on-one physical interaction, you know, those kind of water cooler moments. With HoloLens, as well as some virtual reality technologies, but particularly HoloLens, you can kind of get those water cooler moments by putting on the headsets. And bearing in mind that, you know, one of the key attributes of most technologies is that they get better and faster and more performant over time, they get cheaper over time, and they get smaller over time. We've already got virtual reality glasses from Facebook, you know, so rather than having these big bulky headsets, you know, if you want to just meet your co-workers basically in a say, for example, a mixed reality HoloLens like environment. So there's mesh that Microsoft talk about. You just put on some regular glasses that look like sunglasses. Yeah. And that's it. So 1 minute you're in a hybrid work environment, the next you've taken them off, you're back home again. So you've got that. And then one of the other sort of the big areas that I see sort of coming through when we talk about the future of work is what I call the algorithmic future. And this is where increasingly artificial intelligence is being used throughout the entire employee life cycle for different purposes.
Okay.
So for example, we have artificial intelligences that will trawl through all of the information on CVs, all of the big data out there to try to find the best fit candidate that it can. So say, for example, you're hiring a sales guy. What it will do is you can create artificial intelligence competency matrices of your best sales guy. And you'll say your best sales guy has these hard attributes and these soft attributes. And artificial intelligence will then go off, look through a whole ream of data, and it will come back and say, I found a number of candidates who match this profile. You know, they've got these hard attributes, these soft attributes, and they kind of look like a bit of a clone of your best salesman. Once you then enact a Zoom interview session, those AIs can be involved in that session. We've got companies like HireVue, you've got Eightfold, which is a really interesting AI sort of HR company, which I come on to. And this is where you have a human interviewer interviewing someone via Zoom, for example, but the AI is monitoring that interviewee's camera feed. It's monitoring basically what they say. It will look at microfacial movements, body language. It will figure out, it will listen to the language they're using, the tone they're using, to figure out their educational background, their character, their personality. The AIs basically are increasingly being involved in coaching. So this is where, for example, if I say to you, you know, if we take you on as a potential candidate, can we trust you? And the AIs will come back and say, actually pop something up on the hirer's screen just saying, you asked that question, he said that you could trust him, but actually his pupils dilated and with a 99% accuracy he's lying. Because AI can now tell that you are lying with the accuracy of a polygraph via a webcam. And so this is where the AIs can then prompt the HR manager to say, you might want to ask that question again in a different way to see if you get a different response. So we've got AI in the hiring process that is almost being used as a surveillance-like technology to to figure out if people have particular diseases,
yep,
inherited genetic conditions, because they can tell your blood pressure from your face. They can tell whether you're ill from your voice. You know, if you've got a bit of a gravelly voice, you might actually be ill. You know, you can get huge volumes of data basically just from a webcam and a microphone. It's insane. And there's a Chinese company, for example, that with an 86% level of accuracy can tell whether or not you will become a criminal. So your intent to criminality.
Okay.
You've got Israeli companies that can detect your character and personality, again, kind of with a 90% accuracy. You know, are you trustworthy? All this sort of stuff. So you've got AI there. So you've got AI finding talent. You've got AI helping during the interview process. You've then increasingly got artificial intelligence managing people. So we've seen that with Uber and Amazon.
Yep.
Where AIs have actually been managing people. Amazon, you know, according to Jeff Bezos's latest shareholder letter, they now have an artificial intelligence that will use machine vision in the warehouses, and it will figure out that, you know, if you're always picking up a box like this as a human, if you suddenly pick the box up slightly differently, you might be a bit tired. And if you keep picking it up like that, if you keep picking it up to the side, then you might end up with backache, and you might end up going suing Amazon, or you might end up, you know, costing Amazon money, or you might have to take time off, heaven forbid. So now, for example, within Amazon, you've got AIs that are managing people, but they're also trying to monitor people. And then what they will do is, if they figure that your posture is wrong when you're doing something, they'll try and correct it, but then they'll assign you another task. They'll say, right, I'm going to stop you from picking up boxes. I'm now going to move you over to a fulfillment line, for example. You've got Uber, basically, Uber's AI that recently got taken to court in both the UK and Europe, because it was monitoring the performance of drivers as they were doing various things and then automatically firing them. So when I talk about, you know, the algorithmic work, we have AI finding people, helping hire people, increasingly managing people. There's a platform over in Asia that's managing 400,000 gig economy workers, and they don't know it, and then firing people. And in the Uber's case, the UK court overruled Uber's artificial intelligence and got it to reinstate five of the workers. The others didn't win their cases. So we have this concept of algorithmic work where AI is now becoming your boss.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's before we talk about autonomous companies.
Okay. Awesome. I think if I'm putting myself in the shoes of some of the listeners, especially on the kind of the last point that you were saying, I would think that there would be a significant amount of fear coming up as we're talking about the main trends, but it's more towards this AI trend, right? If you're having some cold, you know, non-hearted AI becoming your boss, making hiring and firing decisions, how does that benefit the individual worker? To me as a listener, it might sound more that the boss, the entrepreneur, the corporation might benefit more than the actual individual.
So inevitably, basically, the individual doesn't really benefit. And that's before we get anywhere near talking about AI bias, et cetera, et cetera. So this is sort of where, you know, when I'm working with the clients that I work with, particularly from an HR and workforce perspective, this is where I encourage basically to kind of like the CHROs and the CEOs and the CFOs, basically businesses, to actually make sure that those businesses maintain their humanity. Because when you're having a look, you know, if you have a look at all of these different things, basically from a company's bottom line, if I can use an artificial intelligence to help me manage you, then I don't need a manager. We've got Bridgewater Associates. They've got $160 billion under asset. They're trying to automate the entire company, starting with the management team, etc. So I can reduce costs because I don't need as many managers. I can use artificial intelligence to monitor your behaviors and your work and your workflow to help me improve your productivity. So that's kind of a benefit there. But when we start having a look at the accountability of these algorithms, they're all black boxes. You know, just as the Amazon and Uber workers have found out, if you're fired automatically by an algorithm, who do you go to? You know, who helps you? Who even understands? You know, which law firm even understands how they can start, you know, ripping these algorithms apart? You know, that's when we get into IP and law, that's a completely different kettle of fish. In addition to that, you know, when you have a look at schools, for example, schools and colleges and universities are still coaching people on, when you get to your interview with a person, this is how you act, this is how you behave. When we have a look at the interview process, a lot of these universities do not tell students, you know, what to do when an artificial intelligence is being used to monitor and surveil your answers, and how you should, you know, react, how you should use, you know, what body language you should use, intonations to be careful of. Mm-hmm. So it's an increasingly worrying trend. You know, we are taking, to a degree, we're taking more humanity out of organizations. And then when you have a look at the Fatbag Collective, so, you know, you can switch in the companies as you like, but kind of Facebook, Apple, Tencent, Alibaba, Google, Amazon, you know, depending how you want to round out the Fatbag Collective as they're known. Increasingly, those businesses are becoming more and more autonomous. You know, and you can see this, but even Airbnb, you know, you can see this basically in their balance sheets. You know, when they say, you know, our revenues are, you know, $100 billion, but the number of employees we have is down here, and our revenue per employee is way up here. You know, when you compare it to sort of older traditional businesses, it's like Airbnb. I mean, Airbnb's average employee earnings is something like, you know, $12 million per individual. Right. So from a business perspective, there's loads of different ways that you can rationalize the use of these new technologies. But then we kind of come to the question of, should you? And just because you can doesn't necessarily mean you should. And that's where you then should really be having conversations and debate about the intelligent and humane use of these technologies, and explaining to employees basically that these technologies are in use and what that means for them, their personal privacy, and all this kind of stuff.
Right. I kind of want to maybe move forward a little bit here, listening to these kind of larger macro trends or mega trends pushing the kind of future of work into the now, into the present. It really sounds like there are, you know, vast potentials for organizations, but also a lot of problems for organizations that don't necessarily take the technology by the reins. What do you kind of see as the future of these organizations that don't take the technology? Like, are they going to be disappearing over the next couple of years? I'm reading a report that came out by McKinsey a couple of years ago that was saying something like the average Fortune 500 company was existing for something like 68 years or something like that. And now it's only 18 years, and, you know, it's just going to keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So there's high turnover in the employees, but also high turnover in, you know, the leading companies in the world. Maybe you can touch on that.
Yeah. So if you step back, say 10 years ago, and you had a conversation with the CEO and say, okay, you know, what are the main things that you kind of care about? You know, it would be certain external factors. So it'd be things like, you know, the economy, markets, et cetera. You know, when you ask them about internal factors, it'd be being able to find and hire and retain the right employees, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Now the vast majority of CEOs basically will say, well, okay, on the one hand, we still care about some of those external economic factors, you know, recession, you know, markets, that kind of stuff. But technology is always on the list. In fact, it's increasingly easy to make the point basically that every single business is becoming a technology business. You know, if you have a look at the automotive industry, so if you have a look at industries that have traditionally always produced assets, you know, manufacturing, and they've produced product, you know, hardware products. If you look at the automotive industry, for example, you know, Ford is a great example where, you know, they say, you know, we're a technology business now. You know, we are writing software for fully autonomous cars. You know, if you have a look at Tesla, you know, they increasingly just refer to their cars basically as, you know, a hardware on software rails, like the car is basically a giant smartphone, you know, with an app. So there are more and more organizations, you know, General Electric, you know, if we sort of look at that kind of extreme, you know, with Predix, they spent $4 billion basically on Predix, which is this giant Internet of Things platform, which will let them query lots and lots of different assets from wind turbines to jet engines in the field in new sort of interesting sort of ways using behavioral languages. So increasingly, you know, banks, you know, look at JP Morgan, Goldman yep. Sachs, you know, Goldman Sachs, it used to be the case that around 10% of the workforce was technology, whereas now increasingly that's edging up to 90% of the workforce are data scientists and technology. You know, JP Morgan is spending anywhere between $1.5 to about $3 billion trying to reinvent itself from a technological footing, you know, particularly when we look at decentralized finance, Bank Four, you know, and competing with fintechs, you know, that sort of stuff. So the general message that this kind of sort of puts out, Bessie, is if you're an organization and you aren't paying attention to the technology or trying to figure out new ways to use it for your own advantage and your customers' advantage, mm-hmm. then you're generally going to be left behind. You know, the pandemic is a great example of that. Yeah. We've seen lots of businesses go to the wall, unfortunately, in part because, for example, you know, they didn't have e-commerce sites. You know, there was in the UK, basically one of the UK's largest retailers basically went to the wall because their e-commerce site was rubbish. You know, and then everyone will tell you that as a retailer, you should probably have a web shop, you know, straightforward stuff like that. But when it comes to trying to sort of get your head around the technologies, you know, what the technologies are, what they can do for your business, why you should care, how you should use them, we're seeing so many more powerful technologies coming through now that it's getting increasingly complex. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be the case that, you know, in the 1980s, the only technology that you really cared about as a business was kind of computing because you knew it would get more powerful and cheaper. And then you'd wonder what you could do with that next year, you know, and the answer would be analyze stuff more, you know, analyze more stuff faster for whatever benefit. Whereas now I'm coming into your business and I'm saying, okay, what, you know, what are you doing with 5G, IoT, digital, cloud, AI, blockchain, AR, VR? What are you doing with conversational artificial intelligence? You know, what are you doing with 3D printing, 4D printing? What are you doing with gene editing? You know, bearing in mind that gene editing is a general purpose technology, which has got serious implications for the energy companies, for example. Yeah, silly stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you sort of go and have these conversations, basically with senior executives, basically they just go, no idea. You know, they used to have to kind of get their head around, you know, what one technology meant for their industry, their business, their future prosperity, their clients, et cetera, let alone all the usual consumer trends and industry trends and mega trends that we talk about. Whereas now, basically, they're having to try to look across an increasingly large spectrum of increasingly cheap, affordable, accessible, powerful technologies that any one of them basically can rewrite the rules of their industry. And that's a challenge. And then we kind of get to that next challenge of, you know, when you have a look at McKinsey, they go, you know, you should have a look at technology. Yeah. And people sort of go, okay, so I've had a look at technology. I think that there are some benefits to our business. And now we get to the point of how do I implement it? How do I deploy it? And then how do I actually future-proof my business? Because as soon as I've deployed that technology, it's generally going to be morphing into something else. You know, if you have a look at AI, we've got artificial intelligences that are now evolving. If you're in healthcare and you're using AI, you need to be able to explain how the AI came to the decision to give that particular patient a particular cancer treatment. So you need explainable AI, you know, and it just piles up. And yeah, you just have these images basically of these executives increasingly within businesses spinning around like a top, like a whirling dervish or a Tasmanian, the old, you know, Disney Tasmanian devil. Yeah. Because they're just utterly confused. And then as all of this stuff is coming to us faster and faster and faster, you know, technology is increasingly powerful, but it's increasingly powerful, increasingly fast. Suddenly you don't have 5 years to figure out what your AI strategy should be. Suddenly you've got 3 years and suddenly, you know,
6 months time, in the future.
Yeah. And suddenly the amount of time that you have to get your head around a technology, figure out what it is, why it is, why you should care and deploy it, is no longer sort of that 5 year window. It's particularly when we talk about competitive advantage, increasingly it's coming to six. You know, when you have a look at Facebook's cryptocurrency Libra could have changed the entire global financial services industry as well as the state's control of money overnight. So when we look at the speed of change, you know, Facebook could put Libra into a platform that has 2.2 billion users and 500 million of them could have used it day one.
And that's probably why it was shut down so quickly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly why, because it threatened states. Yeah. And, you know, if you're a business and I said to you, right, you know, you're JP Morgan, you shut up shop on a Friday and Monday, all of a sudden, 500 million people are using this new cryptocurrency. And I go, did you see that coming? And what are you going to do about it? You're going to be there going, I have no idea what that even is, you know.
Right.
And then it's taking you a year to 2 years to try to come up with a counter strategy. And by that point, Facebook have moved on to the next thing and you're three generations behind.
One of the things that I'm kind of linking here in what you're saying, so you're mentioning a number of different industries, right? Like healthcare, finances, you even mentioned construction earlier on. I think there might be some listeners that could think like, well, I'm in an industry that's protected. It's not going to be affected by this. Do you see that at all? Or is this wave of technological exponential growth going to be impacting everything and everyone over the next decade or two or three decades?
There is not a single industry that is protected from disruption. Yep. And if you like, just to prove I don't really have anything sort of already pre-canned, you can shoot a few industries at me and I'll tell you how they're being disrupted from the core now. So pick the hard ones. Off you go.
You already said construction. So like I come from Canada in a kind of a rural place and people are in construction. People are doing welding. People are doing, using your hands in the trades. I think that is kind of one of the typical things that people say, oh, technology is not going to really impact me. But you already said that construction workers are being impacted in that sense.
Yeah. Okay. So construction. I'm in a particular country, basically I want to build a building. Say it's a four bed house. We'll go with a traditional building, but we can do this with skyscrapers. You know, that's coming through. We can do it with big government buildings. So if I wanted to build a standard detached four bed house in say France, it would typically cost me about 200 to 250,000 euros. It would typically take me about 3 to 6 months, basically, depending on the tradesman that I use and all that kind of stuff. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Go and have a conversation with any construction company. Basically, you know, their figures will vary a little bit, but generally you're kind of looking at that sort of ballpark. Using a 3D printer, I can 3D print that exact same four bed house in under 24 hours, and I can do it for under 20,000 euros. And you can move in once I've sort of put in the windows and I've done some cabling and bits and bobs, because the printers still can't do that. That's coming, but you know, they'll be able to 3D print pipes and electrics straight into the shell of the houses. Yeah. You can move in at the end of the week. Now, from a construction perspective, so on the one hand, we're already using exponential technologies like, say, 3D printing and artificial intelligence and machine vision to help us 3D print a variety of buildings and building formats, basically, in a day for about 90% less cost than it costs to build a traditional building. There's a great video, if the sort of listeners want to go and have a look, go and have a look at the world's largest 3D printed building, basically, was just recently completed in Dubai. And they have these robot 3D printers just moving around the building site. So it's a little bit like a crane. It just spins around printing different layers of this building, a little bit like the way you ice a cake.
Yep.
Firstly, when you have a look at the number of construction workers that you need when you're building buildings in that way, you need about 70% less. But the reason why I say go and have a look at this Dubai video.
I'll put it in the show notes, by the way.
Yeah. The reason why I say have a look at this Dubai video is because one of the human workers is literally sitting on the roof of this 3D printed building in a chair, just watching the printer. It's just going around and around, just printing this thing. So yeah, when we have a look at the construction industry, I can get an artificial intelligence to design your house, your community, or even your city. I can use artificial intelligence in parametric planning. So, you know, it can figure out the best particular layout for that particular house. I can send that wireframe CAD drawing, you know, BIM, whatever, straight to a 3D printer, and it can then go off and print it. And then you can move it in at the end of the week. So amazing. That's construction. and there's a whole conversation on construction.
Maybe I can shift it a little bit here. So like we're talking about industries, we're talking about businesses, but I think, again, the listeners they're individuals. We're all individuals. We're not corporations. So I know that you look at not just the future in the next 10 years, but kind of even further out up to 50 years or so. So when we're talking about kind of the future of jobs itself for the individuals, what's going to be, you know, what are people going to need to be? Is it programming? Is it creativity? What kind of skills are people going to need?
So you've got to have soft skills. So when we have a look at the dates kind of between 2020 and 2040, there's still going to be there's going to be change within the workforce, and that's going to accelerate. But fundamentally, you know, when you have a look at the type of jobs that AI is already starting to take over, particularly in the cognitive space, let alone kind of in the blue collar worker space, it's generally jobs that are automatable. Now, you can automate any job. What I mean by that is, if I can figure out what you do during your daily job and I can break that into a flow chart, I can then write an algorithm for each individual step in that process. And then I combine those algos together, and I've got my AI model. A good example, basically, for example, some things basically that we can automate is Goldman Sachs basically are automating the IPO process. You know, it's got 160 steps. Typically, the IPO process will cost most organizations about $10 million, if you know, particularly the larger ones when they go IPO. Goldman is already automating the entire IPO process. So you can automate anything. You can automate creativity as well. We've got general adversarial networks, what I call creative machines. You've got these kind of coming out of companies, basically from likes of Autodesk. You can also call them generative design platforms. Mm-hmm. And what they will do basically is, you know, they will take an existing product, and you then tell them what you want them to do. So for example, you know, make that product better. Mm-hmm. And they will run thousands of simulations a minute based on what results you want them to enact or to do. Mm-hmm. And they'll run tens of thousands of simulations in virtual reality in a minute. And they'll come up and say, well, you know, based on your parameters and your wishes, I've come up with product version number two. So companies like General Motors are using those. Basically, we've got NASA using them to build rovers. We've got Under Armour using these to artificial intelligences to design trainers. And then they're 3D printed in the back. That cuts down your time, your product development time by 99%. We've got Airbus using artificial intelligence to help them design the A330neo. We've got Amazon using AI to design clothes. And fashion lines and all that sort of stuff. We've got AIs creating synthetic media and content as well. Basically, everything actually, ironically, from podcasts to music to movies to videos to books to you name it. So from a human perspective, you're going to need a bunch of different skills. Firstly, you're going to need to be adaptable. You've got to be entrepreneurial. You've got to basically think like a futurist, because this stuff's changing fast. So we call it kind of exponential mindset. Yeah. You do have to be creative. You've got to be curious as well. You know, children are great at this. You know, it's that why. You've got to be empathetic. You've got to be collaborative as well. You know, but when we talk about your ability to be collaborative, it's not just about being able to collaborate with humans. It's about being able to collaborate with machines. You know, for example, if Siri was all of a sudden your coworker, you know, or Alexa was suddenly your coworker, yeah, how would you talk to them to get whatever result or information you wanted out of them? You know, so that's a different type of collaboration. So in the future, basically, we actually need more human-like soft skills, not less. The fact basically that you should be creative, and creativity, being creative will save you, as a fallacy, as I've already described. You know, we've got AIs making music and art and writing books and all that sort of stuff. That's just innovation is quite easy to innovate. If I asked you to innovate a cup, for example, you know, firstly, you've got to know what a cup is, what it does, you know, it holds liquid. You know, you've got to know that it's probably for a human. So you've got to have that reasoning and contextual information. And AIs are getting increasingly good at that. And then once they understand what a cup is, they go, well, you know, now we'll just design it. So innovation, basically, as every innovation consultancy will tell you, is a process. Mm-hmm. If you can turn something into a process, you can automate it, like it or not. And then when it comes from the hard skills, again, you've got to be able to almost be a jack of all trades. So this is where we move from being T-shaped individuals throughout our career, where I'm an accountant at the start of my career, I'm an accountant at the end of my career, to actually being an accountant at the start of my career, to being a data scientist in the middle of my career, to being a synthetic biologist at the end of my career. And there's this general, when it comes to retraining, we sort of discussed Accenture, you know, there's kind of this fallacy, basically, that if you want to get really good at something, you need to spend 10,000 hours doing it. You know, there was a book that came out years and years ago, and that's kind of where that came from. But actually, if you're an accountant and I want to teach you the basic principles, kind of the 101 principles of how to be a data scientist, I can teach you that within about 20 hours. You know, I can do that kind of within a month. Mm-hmm. And then I just tag team you basically with a data scientist, and then they start doing some on the job training. So as humans, basically, we are absolutely, on the one hand, basically, we are absolutely ingenious. Creativity's got us this far, but we are adaptable. You know, if you could sell me a kettle, you can probably sell me a car. You could probably sell me a house, basically. So, you know, we have an inane ability as humans to be able to learn new knowledge and apply it in new ways. And in a sense, basically, the modern working world beats it out of us.
Because
they will say, you know, it's all very well that you've got all of this different, these different experiences and all this all of this extra knowledge, but I just want you to be an accountant. So a lot of our potential is kicked to the curb. And, you know, when we have a look at our ability to adapt, you know, if I told you, let's say, for example, you have a look at taxi drivers, you know, you get into a taxi and you say to a taxi driver, you know, I can see fully autonomous cars coming through. You know, that must be a worry. They could sort of go, yeah, you know, and then they'll say, well, you know, it's a few years off, which kind of is. And you say, well, you know, what are you going to do when professional driving is automated? And then sort of go, well, I don't really know. I haven't really thought about it because it's about 2-3 years away. Really, if you can see that your job is already at risk of automation, or if you're an CHRO and you can see that jobs are at risk of automation, that's where you go. Today, you're a taxi driver, but we can see these being the jobs of the future, like teleoperations, for example, in the transportation sector. And so what we're going to do is we're going to actually train you to take you from here to here. And so if you can see the jobs that are being automated in time, you transition people from doing this job to this job. And then once that job goes, you just say, look, you're no longer, you know, full self-driving cars already here. You're redundant now. Let's now move you into this new job here. You know, and that's where companies like Accenture are very, very good at sort of seeing what's coming down the line and then actually putting for their own workforce the right policies and procedures in place so they don't have to make people redundant. So we can do it.
Right.
You know, I can train you faster than ever before. If you want to be an artificial intelligence, you know, data scientist, designer, whatever it happens to be, go and have a look at, you know, the Coursera courses. You know, most of them you can get for free.
Yeah.
But the way that most companies act and the way that most people act is I'm going to sit in my status quo. And what do you mean that I'm being made redundant now? You know, I kind of saw that coming, but I just didn't bother doing anything because I just didn't.
Right, right.
That's what's going to get you.
So this ends the first part of our discussion. I hope you found the ideas presented as interesting and compelling as I did. In the final section, Matt and I touch on whether we should have an optimistic perspective towards the future of work, the idea of fully autonomous businesses that can even outlast their founders, whether universal basic income will be necessary or not, as well as a brief insight into how you or your organization can start to future-proof today.